So welcome. Welcome for getting up early. And I would like to start by telling you a bit about myself. My name is Niels Leen here, and I am the creator of HTML5 Test. It's a website for testing web standards. And basically what happens when you visit this website is a whole bunch of feature detection tests are being run. And for each feature that is supported, you'll get some points. And those points are added up, and you'll get a total score, and it is between 0 and 555. Well, why 555? That seems arbitrary. It is. It's HTML5 test, so 555. Okay. Anyway, before I start my actual presentation, I would like to talk a bit about the current scores for desktop browsers on HTML5 test. So the top score browser is Chrome, and Firefox is the runner-up. But there's not that much difference between Firefox and Edge, and that used to be quite differently. So it actually doesn't matter to me that much who is first or second. That's not important at all. So basically, all the browsers listed here, including Safari, is a perfectly good browser for today's web. So the actual results are much more interesting to me than the scores. But the scores are not completely meaningless. They can show interesting trends like this. We can see that Microsoft has done really well since the days of Internet Explorer 6 and 7. So, as I said, Edge is just a couple of points away from Firefox, and in fact, it was the runner-up just a month ago with the release of Edge 14, and at least until a day later when Firefox version 48 was released, and they took that spot again from Microsoft. So Microsoft has done a really lot of work on Internet Explorer and now Edge in the last few years. So let's go over some of the changes since Internet Explorer 6. There's quite a lot. There's all kinds of different specifications, and if you're not impressed with this slide, I have another one for you, and I have another one for you. So a lot of work has been put into Internet Explorer and now into Edge. So, now my actual presentation. Weird browsers. And no, this talk isn't about Internet Explorer 6. So if you're not a web developer, the web may feel like the Wild West. And in some ways, you are absolutely right. Developing for the web is weird by definition. So the web isn't a single platform. So I don't know how many of you are web developers. Okay, that's actually quite well. But to a regular developer, imagine not having one .NET runtime, but 5 or 6 different ones, or 10 or 20. And none of them agree with each other on which standard classes there are and which API should be available. And all of them have their own bugs. And each have a dozen versions that are all in use. And each have their own interpretations how API should work. And some have APIs that do not function at all. And now you need to build an app that works flawlessly on all of them. So that is the normal for web developers. So that sounds really, really horrible, but I think that is actually something that makes the web great. It's not a single vendor or sometimes not even a shared agenda or plan. There is competition. There are browser wars. And that competition between browsers help push the web forward. So this is the new normal. So what are weird browsers then? Well, the lack of organization also allows the web to experiment. to experiment and move into unexpected areas. And so the web already moved from desktop to mobile a few years ago. And mobile browsers were pretty weird back then. But nowadays, I probably surf more on my phone than on my desktop. So what are some of those weird browsers right now? There are some candidates, like game consoles, or portable game consoles, or smart TVs, e-readers, smartwatches, photo cameras, fridges. Some fridges have browsers. 355 points on the HTML5 test. That's not too bad. Cars have browsers. I just bought a new car, and it actually has a browser. It's not that good, but it's a browser. And even VR headsets have browsers. So we can't look at everything today. But I want to look at maybe three or four of those. And I'm going to start with smart TVs and game consoles. And I group them together because they're basically all big screen browsers. Now, the first problem we're going to run into is testing on these devices. I don't know about you, but most people don't have three or four different game consoles. And even smart TVs, most people have one at the most. So how do you test on all these devices? So I went to the MediaMarkt, and I asked them to test the web browsers on their smart TVs. And then they looked at me funny. After some convincing, they walked over to a drawer, handed me five remotes, and allowed me to play with them for the rest of the afternoon. Yeah, that's not really a good story. Well, television browsers are pretty good. So the last generation of television sets use the same operating systems and rendering engines as mobile devices, like Android or Firefox OS or Tizen or WebOS. And they score pretty good on HTML5 tests. Well, the lower ones on this scale are older generations, but the current generation is pretty good with around between 400 and 500 points. If you look at game consoles, it's actually very clear there is a generation gap. The time between the current generation and the previous generation is quite a few years, and that shows. The Xbox One with Edge is an outlier here, because they're the only one that actually updates the browser. All the other ones don't. When the Xbox was first released and it had Internet Explorer, it was right in the middle of the PlayStation 4 and the Wii U. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to show you some differences between television browsers and desktop or mobile browsers. First, I'm going to start with controlling the browser. That's one of the biggest differences and at the same time one of the biggest problems. Because how do you navigate without a mouse, a trackpad, or a touchscreen? Well, you use the D-pad, the arrow keys. And whether it's on a remote or on a gamepad, you just use the arrow keys to move from link to link to link. And when you find the right link or button, you press OK. And that works. But it doesn't work really well. So luckily, there are some alternatives, like an analog controller. And maybe you remember that red little eraser head in the middle of an IBM ThinkPad keyboard. It works a bit like that. And you have remotes with trackpads and a remote with air mouse, which works a bit like the Wiimote. You point it at a screen, and every movement you make with your hands the cursor on the screen follows that movement. That works actually pretty well. Unless you're browsing for 10 minutes, then your arm will fall off. But there's also a second screen. This is the Wii U gamepad. So there's a screen right in front of you. But then again, if you have a screen right in front of you, why bother browsing on the TV at all? Well, some manufacturers also create apps. You can control the whole Xbox or smart TV or PlayStation with an app on your phone, like this app for the Xbox. And again, why would you want to browse on the television then? Because you have your phone already in your hand. Anyway, text input without a keyboard. How does that work? Well, again, the D-pad. And that's very clumsy because you have to navigate from letter to letter to letter to letter to letter. This is very irritating for long URLs. To letter, to letter. Yeah, I'm not going to wait for that. Alternatives. There are remotes with keyboards. And people used to laugh at Google, for example, for their enormous full keyboard remotes for the Google TV. And they compared it with this simple and sleek and minimalistic D-pad of the Apple TV. But for text input, a full keyboard is far, far better solution. And what most people don't realize, you can actually plug a USB keyboard in your smart TV or in your Xbox. And this works. And sometimes they even have trackpads built in. So this is a very good solution if you want to browse on your TV. And again, we have the apps like the Xbox. And then there is something special, gesture control. And that works sometimes. I created a little movie of this. And I'm going to try to mimic exactly the gestures I did to create this movie. So here goes. Now clicking a link, zooming. Yeah. It sometimes works. So how can we control these input methods from JavaScript? We have mouse events, we have touch events, we have keyboard events. How about D-pad events or gamepad events? They might be useful for HTML games, for example. Well, if we want to control the D-pad, that's maybe possible. I say maybe because there are some issues with it. If you think of a remote control, it's basically just a weird keyboard with some weird keys on it. So keyboard events work. But if you have a regular keyboard, you have all these predefined keys, and these have predefined key codes. But on a remote control, those keys are, well, a bit weird, and they are not standardized. So basically, the key codes you get from your remote control, those key codes differ between manufacturer and model. So basically, you know a key has been pressed, but you don't know which one. That's actually an issue. if you just limit yourself to the arrow keys, this will work probably just fine. But any of the other keys, well, they're actually a mystery to the browser which key was actually pressed. The gamepad, yeah, again, maybe that's possible. There is actually an API for that. You call getGamePad, you get an array, and in that array you have all your gamepads, and you can query them for which buttons are pressed. And I was pleasantly surprised because this was supported by every game console. And then I tried to actually use it. And it didn't work on the PlayStation 4. That gamepad array is empty. And it didn't work on the Wii U. That gamepad array is empty. And no matter how many gamepads you connect to the system, it is empty. So it just didn't work at all, except for the Xbox One. Webcam is also sort of an input method. So can we use the webcam, for example, a Kinect or a PlayStation Eye, I think it's called, from a game console? Well, there is an API for that. It's the Get User Media API. And this is actually a little bit outdated version of the API. But because browsers on game consoles and smart TVs aren't updated that often, the new API certainly won't work. So how does this one work? Again, probably the same thing as the Gamepad API. If you call Get User Media, you don't get any streams. The API is there. Except for the Xbox One again. There it will work. So the second difference, the difference between a television and a monitor. The difference is overscan. That's due to historical reasons. The television will not show the whole image. It will chop off the borders of an image. And that happens not when a browser is built into the television, but when you connect it through HDMI, this will happen. So basically, you have an image, and it is enlarged by 5%. Then it is cropped, and the borders will just fall off. If you have content around the sides of your web page, this is a bit of a problem. And also, it causes blurry output, because if you enlarge something, that's not really pretty. There's a solution for this. It's called overscan correction. And it works like this. You add black borders around your content. The browser does this for you. And then when it is enlarged, those black borders will fall off, and your content is fully visible. Except for not every television set enlarges the image by exactly 5%. This can differ between manufacturer and model. So most devices have a setting for configuring the overscan. And this works, but you still have that quality problem. And even if you configure this correctly, and this is the PlayStation 4, you are going to run into some problems. Because if I load a website on the PlayStation 4 browser, and I configured it correctly, and I go to full screen mode, the borders will still fall off. The PlayStation 4 will ignore overscan correction. So, yeah, we need another solution. Why don't we disable overscan? That's possible. Most television sets have a setting to disable overscan. It's called screen fit or pixel perfect or just scan. And this is actually the way the Xbox nudges its users to do. So the Xbox doesn't have overscan correction. So it has the best quality, but I doubt this is actually configured correctly on most Xboxes. And for games, that doesn't matter. But for the browser, it does. In fact, the browser acknowledges this and has a special mode for this. So basically, overscan correction just for the browser. just in case somebody didn't configure it correctly. And even if you disable overscan, there are still some browsers that have problems, like the PlayStation 3, which always shows overscan correction, even if it's disabled. So the PlayStation 3 always uses overscan correction, and the PlayStation 4 never uses overscan correction. Doesn't really make sense. Now, the viewport. And you can fill entire books or entire talks about this subject. I'm going to try to explain it in two slides. First of all, we have a visual viewport that determines what is currently visible on the page. And then we have the layout viewport, and that determines how the page is actually rendered. And if we change the width, the rendering of the page will change. Now, on desktop, the default width of the layout viewport is the same as the width of a window. And if you change the width of the window, the rendering changes. On mobile, it's usually 980 pixels, but you can change that using a meta tag. But on television browsers, this is a different story, because the default layout viewport is different on every device. It's somewhere between 800 and 920 pixels, and you can't change it. So basically, your website will look completely different on all these devices. It's basically all over the place. And another complication, device pixels aren't always device pixels. So sometimes the browser will actually render at a lower resolution. So if you have a 4K screen, for example, it will render mostly in HD. And then upscale to 4K. And that is a bit weird, but it makes sense, because the CPU and the memory in these machines, in these devices, are pretty limited. So this is a way to gain some extra speed. Third difference, the distance to the screen. So usually we sit around 20 inches from our computer monitor, but we don't sit 20 inches from our television screen. It's more like 10 foot. So we need to make fonts and graphics on the site larger to account for viewing distance. People sit proportionally farther from a TV than from a computer monitor of the same size. Basically, that means we need to make text and images 2 to 3 times bigger. And this is why YouTube on the big screen doesn't look like this, but instead it looks like this. There's more contrast, the selection is clear, and the fonts and the graphics are larger. So can we actually identify smart TVs so we can give them special CSS to achieve this effect? Well, there's a standard for that, CSS media types. CSS media types are a very basic standard. It's supported in every browser. And this will work. Simple. Yeah, it's a bit too simple. This doesn't work. CSS media types don't work because every browser says it's basically the type screen. And nobody says it's the type TV and the type... If you have a mobile device, for example, it used to be handheld, but nobody uses that. Everybody uses screen. So is there another way? Screen size? Maybe we can look at screen size. That also doesn't work because monitors of the same, of monitors, computer monitors also have HD resolutions and phones too. And television browsers, as we just saw, often use different resolutions. So this doesn't work at all. Now, user agent sniffing. And that's pretty dirty, but if it works, it doesn't work. There is no universal marker for a television in a user agent string. And that means we can't recognize all smart TVs. And at the bottom here is the user agent string for an LG Netcast television. But nowhere does it say it's a television. Nowhere does it say it's Netcast. It's Safari on Linux, which doesn't make sense. Now, the only way to reliably create an app or create a website for a television is to make two different websites. And it feels like we're going back in time to when we had different mobile websites and yeah, but it's the only way. And there is, well, actually that's not true. You could create a button, for example, that enables couch mode that conditionally loads some extra CSS. And that's actually something that the Vimeo website uses. Fourth difference, be careful with feature detection. Basically, every feature that talks to the operating system or hardware is suspect. And we've already seen that with the Gamepad API and Get User Media. So again, basically, every feature that talks to the hardware operating system is suspect, like I just said. For example, geolocation. There's an API for this, and it's navigator.geolocation.getCurrentPosition. And I do a feature detect here, and the feature is available. So let's forget about that other stuff. Focus on this function call. It actually has two callback functions, a success and failure. When success is called, you'll get coordinates. And when failure is called, you'll get an error code. So this can't go wrong, right? Well, it can. So the first failure. The failure callback is called with a permission denied error code. And this is actually, it's wrong, but it's something we can handle. Apparently, we can't get a coordinates here, so we have a way to deal with this. The second way this can go wrong is a bit more tricky, because no callback is called at all. And this is something that Xbox One used to do with Internet Explorer, but they fixed that now, luckily. Basically, that means that your web page is waiting for a response from this function and keeps on waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and nothing happens. And that's a problem for your users. But those are not the only ways this can go wrong. You could get a call to success. So, yay, we have coordinates. But there are zero and zero. And somebody pointed out to me, this is not necessarily wrong. It's just highly unlikely, because this is in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And there is another way, and that happens on the Google TV, not Android TV, on the Google TV, which is the predecessor. And basically, they return the coordinates of Google's headquarters in Mountain View, California. And yeah, probably that isn't that wrong, because most of the Google TVs are probably still in Mountain View, California, but it's still sloppy. So, I want to go to the next subject, e-readers. Now, e-readers are a bit special. They score pretty low on HTML5 test. And that's expected. That's not something you need to worry about, because they don't support things like audio and video and stuff like that. But they are still pretty special, because they have infrared touchscreens. And infrared touchscreens are quite different from capacitive touch or resistive touch. Basically, you have a whole bunch of LEDs on one side of the screen and a whole bunch of sensors on the other side of the screen. And once you put your finger on the screen, that ray of light from the LED to the sensor is blocked. And that way, it knows where your finger is. That has some implications for events, for mouse events. Now, all of these devices support mouse events. But the resolution is quite low, because for every pixel of resolution, you have to have a physical LED and a physical sensor. But there's another thing. If you have a Kindle or a pocketbook, it says here it supports mouse down and mouse up, which is pretty basic. But it still manages to screw that up. If you put your finger on the screen, nothing happens. And then when you release your finger, mouse down, mouse up. So when you release your finger, it sends the mouse down, and immediately after that, the mouse up. So basically, you can't tell the difference. You can't tell the difference between somebody pressing the screen or tapping the screen. Now, the Kobo does it a little bit better. It does have separate mouse down and mouse up events, and it supports mouse move. But the best one is the Sony Reader that supports both mouse events in the proper way and also supports touch events for one finger. That's a limitation of the technique, but it works. So everybody should buy a Sony Reader, except that that one isn't for sale anymore. They discontinued that model. The e-ink screen is also pretty special. So the basic technology behind this, and it's a lot more complicated than this. This is just basic technology. Microscopic balls with pigments, black and white. And we have electrodes. And when a current is applied to those electrodes, the balls will slowly turn and creating black and white pixels. And if you lose the current here, the balls stay in the same position. So this is very energy efficient. You only have to spend energy for changing the color of changing the pixel. But that also makes it quite slow. Makes it really, really slow. Makes it really, really slow. And in fact, saying that three times doesn't even begin to express how slow it actually is. So I created a little movie. So yeah, maybe those CSS animations and transitions weren't such a great idea after all. And then we have to deal with 16 shades of gray. And two completely different colors can look exactly the same on a black and white screen. So can we identify e-readers, give them special CSS, change some colors, remove animations, stuff like that? Yeah, that's possible. There is a spec for that. Media queries again. CSS monochrome media query. This should work. You probably noticed the theme. No, it doesn't work. Basically, every e-reader I tested thinks it has a color screen. The conversion from color to black and white doesn't happen in the browser. It happens in the display controller. And the browser doesn't know anything about that. So basically, we're stuck to user agent sniffing. And even then, there is no universal marker or token in the user agent string. But we can recognize individual manufacturers and models sometimes. So this is the best I can do. Next subject. I'm going to talk a little bit about portable game consoles. If just a minute. Actually, time-wise, I think I'm going to skip that one. We're going to get to VR headsets. VR headsets. Basically, there are two different major players. The Oculus Rift and the HTC Vive. And there's now HoloLens 2, but that's not actually a VR headset. But some of the things I'm going to talk about also apply to the HoloLens. Like, they are very expensive. They're extremely expensive. You need an expensive VR headset, and on top of that, for both the Vive and the Rift, you need a high-end computer with a very fast graphic card. But no matter how much money you spend, you look extremely geeky wearing them. But if you don't mind looking geeky, there is also a cheaper way. You can experiment with VR for far less money. So you can reuse your phone and play around with Google Cardboard. You put your phone inside of this cardboard box, and there are some lenses, and the phone will show two images on the screen, and if you put it on your head, it will look like VR. You can buy compatible headsets that are a bit more comfortable for 30 or 40 euros. And this is the cheapest and simplest way to play with VR today. But it's more like a hack than an actual platform. So Google announced Daydream, showed the first Daydream compatible device yesterday. And it's a bit more advanced, but it's still basically the same thing. But it's a little bit more comfortable than putting something from cardboard on your head. But it will take some time to get here in the Netherlands. So if you want to try VR today, there is the Samsung Gear VR. And it's more than just a headset with a couple of lenses. There is actually, it has sensors that track your movements, and it has a gamepad or a trackpad on the side of the headset. Again, you need to put your phone in this device. And you need a Samsung Galaxy S6 or S7 or a recent Galaxy Note. Don't use the Note 7, but that one will explode. But this will cost you around 100 euros for this headset. And then, of course, your phone. And if you have a browser, it will look a bit like this. It actually worked really well. And I was amazed about how easily your brain is fooled into thinking you're in a real 3D environment. But the browser is still flat. It's a bit like a painting floating in 3D space. And you can look around, but it isn't really more than that. But there is a new specification. There's a specification that can make VR work on the web. And it's called WebVR. And it's basically WebGL on steroids. It's kind of like the perfect companion to WebGL. It allows you to enter a WebGL scene and look around and not just look at it on a flat screen. So it adds head tracking, allows you to move the camera of the WebGL scene in the direction you are actually physically looking at. And it takes into consideration the geometry of the lenses. And finally, it also allows you to project the 3D scene to two different eyes, so you have an actual depth sensation. And apart from this, there are extensions to web audio for spatial audio and the Gamepad API. And this is supported in experimental builds of Chrome and nightly builds of Firefox and behind a flag in Samsung Internet Today. Well, because the spec is still in flux, there hasn't been any public releases of this. And for Chrome and Firefox, you still need an headset like the Oculus Rift or the HTC Vive. And for Chrome on Android, you need a Cardboard or a Daydream-compatible headset. And Samsung Internet, that's the browser that runs on the Gear VR. And Microsoft announced earlier in September that they will bring Web VR to Edge 2. Well, they haven't actually given any more details than that. But and apart from coming to Edge, that can mean many things. There have been some changes to the spec that make it easier to integrate with the HoloLens. So who knows, maybe we'll see Web VR support on Edge on the HoloLens too. I don't know. If you want to check the current state of support, there is a website for that, is webvrready.org. And that means it's time for a little demo. This is a WebGL scene, very simple WebGL scene, and it's just in a browser, and you can move around by dragging the cursor in the window. And actually, if you use the Samsung Internet browser on the Gear VR, it's still flat. But you can enter a special headset mode. And if you enable that, you actually enter the scene, and it literally feels like you're standing in front of that spinning cube. And this video actually doesn't do it justice. It really is weird that your brain can be fooled this easily. So, are there weird browsers left? And I think the answer to that is definitely yes. So, I want to leave you with a very inspirational quote from Jason Grigsby. We cannot predict future behavior from a current experience that sucks. And I sincerely hope he is right, because the current experience definitely sucks. But wait, like I said, I told you already at the start, these weird browsers are just browsers. And when we create websites, we don't know what our visitors are going to use. Some of our users may be visually impaired or use a screen reader, and some may use their mobile phone. Some may use an e-reader or a game console. And that means the web isn't a single platform. And the fact that there's a multitude of browsers is inherent to the web, and that's what makes it great. The web is for everybody. So this talk isn't supposed to scare you away from developing for the web. This is the worst it can get. But web developers already know how to deal with this stuff using feature detection and progressive enhancement and responsive design. So this talk is about opportunities, about how the web is constantly changing and moving into weird directions. And you can take advantage of that. And if there's one thing I want you to take away with this talk today, is the web is more than just Chrome and Safari and Edge. So, thank you. So, if you want to see more talks about the web, there is a talk in about 15 minutes in room G106 by PPK. It's about choosing the future of the web. And Jeff Bertoff will talk in the auditorium at 11:15 about progressive web apps. And I'm around for the whole morning at the expert zone. So if you have questions, just come see me.